We've read ahead a little bit and been looking at it. Nehemiah chapter 3 is a lot of really hard names to pronounce. And so it's like a really hard name, a really hard name, a really hard name, and the fish gate. And then it's a really hard name, a really hard name, a really hard name, and the dung gate. And it goes on anyway. So we are not going to read all the way through Nehemiah chapter 3 this morning because it's just got a lot of hard names to pronounce. And Jim has been practicing. So if, Jim, you want to give it a shot. He told me the other day that he has been reading, getting ready for this morning, and I appreciate that. But there's a couple of different ways we can look at Nehemiah chapter 3. And some of the different teachers that I've listened to, some of the different books I've read, they'll get into the names of the wall that are there. There's a tower and there's walls, and they'll get into the names of the people. And they really dig deep and try and find some really good meaning to it. And I'm not going to do that this morning. What I want to look at is, as I read through it, something struck me that was really neat. And it's taking all of these people that were involved in the building project and looking at kind of their background and these people that all joined together and had a really good building project, and it was a good thing. We've seen that in Nehemiah already. He's looking at this good thing that they were about to do and partake in. And so we're going to kind of look at their names a little bit and who they were and where they were from, and then try and apply that. But we're not going to get into the really deep meanings of all of the names of the gates and stuff. And so that's why we start here in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And it's a great passage on unity. And if we start at verse 12, and I'll just read down through a little ways here, probably about verse 26 or so. And it says, "For even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we are all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and we were made to drink of one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot says, 'Because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason any less a part of the body. And if the ear says, 'Because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason any less a part of the body. For if the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he desired. If they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need of you,' or again the head to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor, and our less presentable members become more presentable, or much more presentable, whereas our more presentable members have no need of it. But God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, so there may be no division in the body, but that the member may have the same care for one another." And with that, you can turn back to Nehemiah chapter 3. And even if you want to go back to Nehemiah chapter 2, we're going to kind of start there. This morning, John left off in Nehemiah chapter 2, and we're going to pick up on verse 17 where he left off, and just kind of cover a couple of verses here, and then dig into chapter 3. I work, as you so learned a couple of Sundays ago, I work in the medical field. And it is very difficult to try and come in and teach Sunday school while I'm at work because people tend to get sick on Sunday mornings as well. Actually, I've had really good success for the times that I have been at work teaching Sunday school. There have been very few times that I've had to run out of here, but that one Sunday was one of them. But as I look at this passage in Nehemiah and I look at the body of Christ and the unity that needs to be there in the body of Christ, I began pondering what I do for work. And we try to explain to people all the things that need to be done. And when I work a cardiac arrest, when somebody's gone into cardiac arrest and we have to start CPR, People will ask me at times, why do so many ambulances show up at one house? And they have no idea what's going on inside of that house. So I'm going to kind of explain it a little this morning very quickly so that, one, you understand what's going on and why we have so many people involved, but also that I can pull it together here for Sunday school and apply it. But when we go into that house and somebody's in cardiac arrest, I need one person to immediately begin CPR and start those chest compressions, because other than the defibrillator or the shocking them, the best thing for them is CPR. So we immediately got one person dedicated to just pushing hard and fast on their chest. And then I take another person and I put them in charge of getting IV access. I need a line into them somehow so I can begin to administer medicine to them. And there's a multitude of ways that we can do that. But when somebody's heart isn't pumping and they have no blood pressure, starting a line is sometimes difficult. So we have one or two people that are trying to do that. And if that fails, I just have this really cool drill and I just drill a needle right into their bone. That one's hard to miss. And then once I've got that, I've got somebody that's in charge of delivering medicine exactly at the right time every 3 to 5 minutes when I ask for it. And I take another person, I put them in charge of the monitor, and they get that monitor all hooked up, and they put the patches on there so that if the monitor says so, we can start shocking them. Some have referred to it as riding the lightning. But we can begin to administer that. And then I'll take another person. I'll put them in charge of getting some medical history for me. And so if there's not a bystander there or a family member there, we just go and we start rifling through people's drawers. We'll go into your bathroom and we'll start digging through medicine cabinets and whatnot, looking for some indication as to what is going on with this person. And we get very invasive, not only in their personal life at that particular moment, but in their house. And so I've got someone doing that. And usually what I do when I'm in charge of that call is I just kind of step back. And I don't get my hands on. I just kind of start giving jobs and assigning them. Another job that we have to do is maintain their airway because, well, all this is going on. They have to breathe as well. And so I've got another person there that's in charge of their airway. I can easily put six people to work when somebody's in cardiac arrest. And what's really neat about the whole thing is very, very rarely, but almost never, does anybody sit there and argue with me. When I ask them to do a job, they begin that job and they do it, and usually I just trust that they're going to be able to do that job well. I don't put people in jobs that I'm worried that they are not qualified for or trained for, but sometimes people will get put in a spot where they've never really done it before, but they don't argue with me. I say, do this, and they start doing it. I ask them to do that, and they start doing it. If my chief walks in and I say, chief, I need you to start doing chest compressions, he doesn't look at me and say, well, I am the chief, and that's a little bit beneath me. I probably should be the one doing the airway. We don't get that, and it's amazing how on that scene everybody just starts working together. And one person kind of steps back and starts giving assignments and whatnot, and we all know our little jobs, and we do them, without arguing or complaining. And the biggest thing is, because if we all start fighting on scene, someone dies. It's just plain and simple. They don't have a good chance anyway if they're in cardiac arrest and I'm there doing CPR on them. But it's a guarantee that if my crew starts to be dysfunctional, somebody dies. So my question is, when we start looking at the church, do we kind of put the same emphasis in the reality that if we as a church don't work together in unity, people die? And it gave me goosebumps as I say that, because it's not just that they die now, but it's possible that they die and are separated forever. For eternity, somebody could be separated from God because the church is dysfunctional. And this chapter, as I was reading it, was a good wake-up call for me in just pondering unity. And that's as I've looked at chapter 3 here and looked at the unity that's in there, it just really got me thinking on the unity in the church. And one of the nice things that we have here at River Valley is very little dysfunction. I think for the most part, we do well at working together. But when we look at the universal church and the dysfunction that is in the universal church right now, when we are not working together as God designed for us to work together and doing the things that he has asked us to do, whether it's a tiny little job or whether it's the more glorified job that we place different emphasis on, if we don't work together and function together in unity, people die. And people die and spend eternity in hell. And that's a big wake-up call for me as I began to ponder this. If we don't function the way God designed for us to function, people don't hear the gospel. And people are turned off at the gospel because they look at this dysfunctional group of people and they don't want to hear that message. And if they don't want to hear that message or that message is not told to them, their death is forever. And that's just a harsh, tough way to start this morning. But it is what God has impressed upon my heart as I went through this. And so I want us to look in Nehemiah chapter 3 and see something really cool as they go through this. But let's start in chapter 2 first, because we have a really cool motivational speech. And we don't really know a whole lot about was said. But in chapter 2, verse 17 of Nehemiah, Nehemiah says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.'" So that's his start of his motivational speech. What are some key words? There's three separate spots in this passage where we see some neat unity that Nehemiah starts. He used the term we. What's another term that he used? Us. And then he used we again. But he said, the bad situation we are in. Now, I don't know exactly how old Nehemiah is at this particular moment, but if he was born in Israel, he would have been an infant when captivity started. We're about 60 years or so into captivity. So however old he is, he would have been a very young child, if not an infant, when Israel was taken into captivity. Or he was possibly born in captivity if he's younger than 60. And so how much of the reproach and captivity is Nehemiah's fault? Well, individually, we would say it's really not a lot his fault at all, because either he was an infant or he wasn't even there. So the problem that Israel is in isn't really Nehemiah's personal problem, personal fault, I guess. He makes it his problem, though. And that's the neat thing about what Nehemiah does here, is he doesn't come into this and say, look at the reproach that you guys are in here in Jerusalem, and I'm here to fix your problem. He said, I'm here to fix our problem. I'm here to fix this bad situation we are in. And he says, come, let us rebuild, and so that we will no longer be a reproach. And so he uses these words in verse 17 that pulls himself into this problem, and he begins to build that unity, because this isn't the first time that Jerusalem, or the walls of Jerusalem, have been attempted to be rebuilt. I believe it was about 10 years prior to this. There was also a time where they went to try and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and the king had it stopped, and there was a lot of things that went on, and they were unable to keep it going. And so they've already failed at this once, and so Nehemiah, in his speech here, not only is just motivating a group of people to start a new project, he's motivating a group of people to restart a project that they've already failed at once. And I think that's harder to do, to get people going again on something that has already failed, than to try and motivate people the first time. So Nehemiah owns the reproach that Israel is in right now. He makes it personal, and he begins to develop that leadership, or that ownership and the unity, and he does that as a leader. He, again, didn't come to say that he was here to clean up somebody else's mess. He was here because God had called him to rebuild this project, and he wasn't blaming anybody for that. After he makes it personal, then he starts to get them excited about this work. And it's verse 18. If someone would read verse 18 of chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 18.
Let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work.
So one of the reasons why the project had been stopped before is because of the king. He had shut down this project, and John talked about how when they went back to look at the archives as to what was going on, they happened to not find, or they skipped over the part where the king had said, shut it down. So when the king was looking at this, he didn't find that part of the archive. So Nehemiah shares with them, you know, the king is behind this. And it's his motivational speech to them, and he shares how God had been at work. He shows how Nehemiah's heart had already been prepared, and we've seen that in chapter 1. God had been preparing Nehemiah's heart. Again, captivity was his home. It's where he had grown up. It's where he had been raised. It's what he knew. It's what was familiar to him. And not only was it that familiar, or not only was that culture there familiar to him, he was living in the palace. He was the king's cupbearer. So he was there serving the king. He had the trust of the king. He was able to walk into the presence of the king and be around that. And the king and him had such a relationship that when he was down and it was showing on his face that that his demeanor had changed, the king recognized it. And the king asked him, you know, what's going on? Why aren't you yourself lately? It wasn't like the king just seeing this guy walk in and serve him his food and wine. The king and Nehemiah had a personal relationship. And yet, with that, God prepared Nehemiah's heart for his homeland. And when the country of his home was torn apart and the walls of his city were torn apart, it hurt him. And he wanted to see it better, and so God prepared Nehemiah's heart. God prepared the king's heart. How do we see? And it's not right here, but what are some of the ways that God prepared the king's heart as well? Going back and
he didn't shut it down once.
He was ready to do it again, so he changed his heart there. What are some other ways that? The king helped, or the God changed his heart and prepared a way for Nehemiah.
Oh, his response when Nehemiah told him that why he was discouraged.
Yeah, he was fully on board right away.
He was concerned.
He was concerned. He wanted to know really how he could help.
He gave him letters for self-passage.
So not only did God changed the king's heart, but he prepared the physical, geographical pathway for Nehemiah to get there. The king wrote those letters to basically give Nehemiah safe passage through the provinces to get there. And so Nehemiah didn't have to worry about fighting battles along the way to get there. He had letters from the king. And not only did he have letters from the king for safe passage, he had a letter from the king for the king's forest. And so God prepared the building supplies that they were going to need. And so Nehemiah shares this with the people, and that how God has been working for the last months, maybe years, in preparing everything that needed to be prepared. Nehemiah motivates the people and sharing not about what Nehemiah has been doing to prepare the way, but he shares and motivates them with what God has been doing to prepare the way. And he points it all towards God and how God has prepared the way. And that's when the people got excited. And then they used a good unity word there as well, and they said, let us rebuild. They were excited, and they wanted to get into that. The next couple of verses in chapter 2 is where we begin to see some opposition for Nehemiah. And John's going to really dig into opposition next week. And so I'll just let him kind of cover and get into the opposition. But we see right away, we begin to see opposition. And that's part of vision, that's part of building, and that's part of going forward. Over the last couple of years, not years, over the last couple of months, and I'm going to put my brother-in-law on the spot a little bit. But over the last couple of months, it's been really cool watching how God has worked in their family. And as Derek will come over to the house and share stuff with us, it's really cool because he'll just show up at the house. And just, you know, when something's there, the doorbell will ring and Derek's there. And it just needs to share that. And it's exciting because it's exciting for us. to hear what's going on. And as they have been here on their sabbatical, just waiting on the Lord to give them guidance and direction, we've been able to walk with them as God has been directing them. And as Derek is beginning to put a ministry together, and I'm not going to give you all the details of it. I'll let Derek share the details of his ministry. But it's been cool to see how God is preparing his heart and his family's heart. And out of their hurt, there's a ministry, a project that is being built. Out of Nehemiah's hurt for his country, for his city, a project came together. And it's been fun to watch Derek's vision and his family's vision come together. And what's been really cool is to watch how God's preparing the way. And that's the cool part. Every time he comes to the house and he shares with me something, and he's like, man, out of nowhere, I get a phone call. And it's amazing how many people have your phone number. and people that he didn't give his phone number to, and he gets these phone calls. And somebody's like, man, we heard about your ministry, what you're beginning to put together, and we are on board. We're excited with that. And to hear him come and say, hey, this guy's packing up and they're moving to Mesquite. Because they're on board with this ministry, people that you just wouldn't expect. And it's been cool, because out of the hurt came a vision and a project, and out of the prayer and seeking God comes the provision, and the hearts have been prepared, the provisions are being prepared, an office space comes available, and it's just neat. A lot of little things that God is opening up and preparing, and as I've been reading Nehemiah and watching this, how God, out of hurt in Nehemiah's heart, a building project around this city, God prepared and all that. And then with Derek and his family, out of hurt came a vision for a project. And now God is totally preparing the way for it. And so as I've been going through this, it's been fun to correlate and neat to correlate to the modern day of how God is still doing that today. It's not something he did for Nehemiah thousands of years ago and then just stopped doing. He's still a God who, out of hurt, will lay a vision out there. And if God's going to lay a vision out there, you know God's going to provide for that vision. He's going to prepare the way and the path for that vision to unfold. And so it's been really neat for me and my family to, as we sit there and we just get to listen and share in that excitement. And we're excited as we see how God is working in that. And so let's look at this project that happened for Nehemiah. Nehemiah, we're going to, yes.
Before you go there, and maybe I spaced out, you mentioned that or something, but I think there's something that's very encouraging and significant with the response that people had.
Yes, let us.
Let us start building, and they began. You know, it wasn't pulling teeth or
breaking
them into it. I think that had a lot to do with what's happening in the future with the attitude of people, and they responded to God's purpose.
And we see that motivational speech from Nehemiah, and the people were on board, and they moved forward, and they were, as he said, let us fix these walls, let us rebuild the city so that we won't be a reproach. The people said, yeah, let us rebuild. You know, they were on board, and it's because God had prepared their hearts as well. It wasn't, you know, it was nice that Nehemiah had a really good speech prepared, but we know that God had prepared their hearts as well. Their hearts were ready for that moment when the building project needed to be done. And so they begin this project, this good project, this good build. Several years ago, right behind Bank of Nevada, if you know where that is, there's a little subdivision there that's just kind of to the north and east. Several years ago, the retaining wall back there fell down. And for several years, it was just this ugly wall that sections of it had, whether it was a water line that broke or whatever happened, just kind of sloughed off the hill. And so this retaining wall was very ugly, sitting there, broken. And it was just a couple of years, probably 2 years, that this wall had been broken. The plants had all died. And it was this little thin wall that ran maybe a couple hundred feet in the sections. And sat there broken for several years. Finally, 6 months ago, they began to rebuild that wall. And what they did is, they didn't even rebuild at all. They just kind of rebuilt a section of it, put it up there. And it took, I don't know, it took 4 or 5 months of skilled laborers to fix this wall. And this wall was like 8 inches thick and maybe 10 feet high, if that. And it took, and it was several months that it took for them, and they weren't going 8 hours a day, but it was several months for them to get this little tiny section of wall put up. I'm guessing it was like maybe 50 feet of wall total that they finally put up, and they just made a really pretty hill out of the rest of it. Anyway, so 3 to 4 months for them to put 25 feet of wall or 50 feet of wall back up that was only a little, you know, about 8 inches thick. Several thousand years ago, a wall around a city was knocked to the ground. And when they talk about knocking a wall to the ground, they knocked these walls down and they pushed the walls down into the valley below the city of Jerusalem. And so, you know, several feet below where the wall would have stand, you know, 25, 50 feet down into these valleys, they pushed these walls. And so for 60 years, these big stones are pushed down into the valleys below, and Nehemiah begins to say, we're going to rebuild these walls. These walls were about 2 miles long, over 15 feet high, and 8 to 16 feet, depending on where you would be at that particular section of the wall. So picture that, at least 15 feet high. And what's the ceiling here, 12? 10. So, you know, at least 5 more feet above this city, this ceiling, and that's a minimum. Some read as much as 20 to 25 feet high that these walls were. And the rocks and stones that needed to be moved to put this wall back together were down in the valley and had to be dragged back up, and they didn't have really cool cranes and tractors and stuff. This is going to be a project that's being done by hand. And in 52 days, they build 2 miles of wall that's 15 feet high and over 8 feet thick. 52 days. We can't get 25 feet of wall done in 3 months. Anyway, we see here the project. These stones that were at the bottom of the hill would have had debris and other stuff over top of them. Wind blows the sand around, and so they would have been not just grabbing these stones and hauling them up. They had to dig the stones out and haul them back up a hill to build this wall. So it was a project, and it was done in 52 days. At the end of the chapter, we see that it was completed. And it's just, again, really neat to see how when people work together, God can accomplish great and wonderful things. So let's look at the people that were involved in this project. The North Wall, and again, we're not going to dig into these names and stuff like that. I'm going to mention a few little names, and I'm going to pronounce them really bad. The North Wall is where we start, the first couple of verses there. And we see here a high priest that was the first person mentioned who was starting to build this wall. How much masonry and wall building experience did the high priest have? Probably not a lot, but he's the first one that we see starting to build this wall. He's in charge of the spiritual side of the nation of Israel, not necessarily the physical protection of the city. But there he is building the wall. Then we have the men from Jericho. The men from Jericho came to participate in this building project. Jericho was at least 17 miles away. Today we'd say 17 miles away, no big deal. Back then, them traveling 17 miles would be the equivalent of us traveling approximately 430 miles today if we were driving on a freeway. And so it would be like us going to a building project in Grand Junction to help them in a building project. So they weren't just down the street. They weren't getting to go home to their families. And so for 52 days, the men from Jericho were involved in a building project that took them away from their families. It took them away from their city. It took them away from their protection. But they were there to help rebuild the city of the walls around Jerusalem. Zakur, son of Ammi, maybe. He is mentioned a couple of times in Nehemiah, but again, somebody that we don't even really know much about him, but he was there. The fish gate was built up, these people were building the walls, these people were building the gates. Mirmoth, the son of Uriah, again, Uriah was a priest who would not have been a wall builder by trade. Several other men are mentioned, but not really a lot of references to who they may have been. So we're getting a whole list of people that we don't know much about, but we're getting a list of people that we do know enough about to know that they're not wall builders. And that's the neat part of this, is we're seeing people that are not not wall builders. Tekoa, these people traveled 10 miles to help rebuild the wall, so that'd be like driving to Victorville, California, to go help with a building project. These men came, and what's neat about this group of people, as you read through those verses there, is they came and they didn't have the support of their leadership. And so these men came against the will of their leadership in their city, but they were willing to do that. They found that it was more important to be a part of the building project there, of the walls around Jericho, than support their leadership. There's speculation as to why the leadership of their city was not supportive. It's possible that it was in the area of Geshem, the Arab, who was one that you'll see caused trouble while the walls were being built. So the leaders may not have wanted to fall in the bad graces of their of that guy who was governing over their area. Maybe they were a part of his leadership and were against the project. But here we have a group of men that not only traveled 10 miles to be there to help out, but they did so without support from their leadership. And then we build the West Wall. And Kobe, I believe in a little file somewhere in there, a couple weeks ago, we put a picture of Jerusalem or the walls of Nehemiah's time. While we're going through this, if look at that. He is like Johnny on the spot. So here we have the West Wall, and then Geshana, the gate. Men from Gibeon and Mizpah. Again, men who traveled 5 to 8 miles to be of help there. Verse 8, the guilders, or the goldsmiths. These are people that, again, how much experience did the people have building walls as a goldsmith would? You know, he's not a person that generally is involved in the heavy projects and the building projects, but here they were building. Raphai, if the PH is pronounced with an F, a ruler in Jerusalem, not one who decided that he was just going to rule over his people, but one who decided that he was also going to get involved in the building project. Verse 10, Jedidiah, maybe? A guy who lived near that section of the wall and would have wanted security. And so he had a personal interest in making sure that this section of the wall was built, because that section of the wall was going to be the section that offered him security. The Tower of Ovens, verse 11. Again, a lot of speculation as to what that section is. Some speculated that it would have been the area where the bakers were, and they had their ovens in that area. So that they could go and bake. Again, I didn't spend a lot of time reading into the exact meaning of everything. A lot of speculation. Shalom in verse 12, he had no sons, but his daughters were willing to work. And so it wasn't just a man's job here. The women participated in this as well to make sure that this project got done. So they weren't just at the sidelines of the building project, baking and cooking and providing nourishment for the men. They were getting right in there and getting their hands dirty and building these walls as well. And so it's just neat to see the diversity of the people that are in this. The Southwest Wall, verses 13 and 14, we see a couple more gates that were built, the Valley Gate, the Dung Gate. The Southeast Wall had the Fountain Gate. Another man named Nehemiah traveled from a town about 16 miles away to be a part of the building project. There, verse 17, we see that there's Levites and priests involved in the building project. The Angle Wall, there is a man there that is mentioned, not that he just participate in the building project, but how does it say he participated? In verse 19, Zabi, 20?
Zealously.
He participated zealously. So this wasn't something that this guy just took on grudgingly, going, oh, everybody else is building. I better be a participant. I don't want to be the guy that looks bad by not being involved. These people were zealously participating. Verse 22 through 27, we see that there's more priests involved, not just from Jerusalem, but priests that were traveling throughout the area to be a part of this project. And then we have the Northeast Wall, which we see there's a couple other gates The inspection gate probably was a gate in the days when they were bringing food and whatnot into the city, and there was merchants and guilders that worked in those areas as well. And so it's neat to see the different professions that are involved in this. And we just cruised through that chapter, and I'm going to tell John that I can cruise through a chapter in about 10 minutes, maybe less. It took him like 3 weeks. But what's neat about this is that the group of people that were willing to participate in this thing. So what stands out to you? As we cruise through that and just look really at the profession of people than anything, or the distance they had to travel, what are some things in that stand out to you? Absolutely.
Nobody said, well, I don't do that.
No.
No.
Yep.
What do you need me?
Yeah.
Where do you want
me? It appears that you don't have to follow any environmental impact.
I should have brought, I don't have it, but I have, it's not with Nehemiah's building project, but I have a modern-day Noah when he had to build the ark, and they talk about the impact fees and the building project and the using the special kind of wood and all the things that by the time they were done dealing with the city, they would have just quit. It would have been easier to drown than get that boat built. Anything else that you see that stands out to you as we go through chapter... There was a unity. And that's why I wanted to start with 1 Corinthians chapter 12, is because as we go through this, we see, even though the word unity isn't used in this passage, I think we see it demonstrated very well. These people work shoulder to shoulder, and it just goes on down the line of from this wall to this gate, from this gate to this wall, from this wall to this gate.
Well,
these people work together.
Each section here, who did it?
Yep.
To understand that there is a place for us and God wants to use us, because it is a life and death situation.
This last week, River Valley had a milestone, and we had River Valley's very first ever deacons meeting. And it's exciting to see those milestones, the little things that happen. But one of the things Pastor Craig told the deacons is, as we were talking about building the deacon board, and he said, you're chosen, and we looked at you guys for being deacons because you were already doing the job of the deacon. And he told that to the elders as well. And as we looked at the elders in the church, it wasn't like, here, now start doing this. He said, you guys have been, we have looked at you and chosen you as elders in the church because you're already doing it. Now you just got an extra little title. But the thing is these people are already doing the job, and that's how we are in the church. And as we look at that and see that, you know, these people are invested, and we need to be invested in the church, whether we have a title or not. It's not about the title. And that's why these men stood out, is because it wasn't about the title. They were doing the job. And that's what's neat about the unity in the church is we have giftings, but sometimes you're going to have to do a job that you're not gifted at, that you don't feel is your spiritual gifting. But there will be times when that we just need to do that kind of work because it needs to be done. And these people did it. They did the job because it needed to be done. They were excited about it because of what it meant in the future. And so they worked and they were unified. How many different... Oh, Pastor Craig. No.
I just had one other thought. You know, we were talking about how long it took them to build that 50
Yep.
Versus these guys, and one thing these guys had that they probably didn't was God.
Yes.
And these all recognized that in chapter 2, verse 20. They said, and so I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us, therefore we, his servants, will rise and build. And they recognized their source of what was going to happen.
Absolutely. And so it's neat to see that. You know, they recognized what needed to be done. They recognized who was going to help them do that. And as John and I were talking about how we were going to kind of go through the book of Nehemiah, we started off with, well, let's kind of always try and bring it back to the building project. And the more we dug through this, it ends up being leadership is what we see a lot of in here. I think it was Jim the other day asked me, he's like, are we going to be able to be a part of the building project? And absolutely. And one of the things when we were sitting down talking to the contractor that's helping us get the church together was we asked him a very specific question. And we said, will you allow for us as River Valley to be a part of the building project? Because if you won't, we'll look for somebody else that will, because we are going to be a part of this building project. And he wrestled with that for a minute or two, because he realized a dynamic that he was never really a part of before. He's used to going in and being in charge and building something, and then the people that had him build it move in. And we're going to be a part of that. And it doesn't matter what your profession is. Doesn't matter what you did for a living or where you're at right now, there will be something for us to do there and to participate in. And as Jim and I were talking about, you know, who here is skilled with a hammer and who here is skilled with putting up sheetrock or involved in those kind of things. And there's not many of us here that are professional builders. But there's going to be projects to do. And I mentioned one of them might be we just might have a clean up the construction site day where we come together and just tidy it up. Or maybe it's just have the barbecue there and we cook and we participate. But there's going to be projects for us to do, because this is going to be our church building, River Valley Bible Church.
Just make an announcement. We need
I don't know how we'll figure those details out as we get there as to how we're doing it, but we're going to participate in this building project.
Good.
And it doesn't matter what our profession is or what we did for a living, whether you're a guy or a girl, we get to participate in this, and it's exciting.
So they'd be something for us with low skill level.
That's right. For sure.
Even though we're, you know, some of these people came from afar, but some of them did.
They took care of their front yard. Kay, did you have your hand up? I thought I seen a hand back there. Not to put you on the spot, I'm sorry. I've got like 2 minutes.
I'll talk in 30 seconds.
Okay.
I just thought the legacy of everybody's name in here was so neat. Mm-hmm. But how embarrassing for the Tekoa
leadership. Their name still goes down in history. You leave a legacy, what will it be?
Oh, I'm just going to go off what Jim said. Having everybody participate in it gives everybody a sense of ownership.
Absolutely.
This is part mine.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's exciting. There's so much more I could talk about. Let me leave you with a quote from John F. Kennedy. He was talking about his country, and he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. But if we just change the word country. Ask not what your church can do for you, but what you can do for your church. Ask not what the church can do for you. Ask what together we can do for the freedom of man. And not just the freedom that we think of as Americans, but the freedom that we have as believers in Jesus Christ. What can we do together for the freedom from the bondage of sin? Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for examples in Scripture that we can look at and see your unity being demonstrated. Thank you for Nehemiah, the leader of this project, how he demonstrated unity, how he was willing to participate in that, and to be able to take the walls that were destroyed so bad that a donkey couldn't even walk through them. He was able to rally a group of people. And we say him, but we know it was you. We know that you rallied those people. You motivated them. You prepared the hearts. You prepared the way. And we praise you for that. And we just ask, as we go into our building project, we ask that you will continue to prepare the way, to rally our hearts, to prepare us for what we have in store for the next couple of months and maybe even a year. And we just ask that you will guide and direct and unite us as we go into this project. And we just ask you for that, and we give you the praise in advance. In Jesus' name, amen.